Hello and welcome to the Pastcast. I'm Callum Henderson. My guest this week is Professor Ian Haynes, an archaeologist who's been involved in the Elusive Sculptures project. As its name suggests, Elusive Sculptures has sought to track down and record some remarkable hidden archaeology scattered all across the country. Funded by the British Academy and the Leverhulme Trust, the project has recently concluded an investigation into Romano-British art that has been preserved in some very unlikely places in the hinterland of Hadrian's Wall. Ian has written about the project's findings in the latest issue of Current Archaeology magazine. His article, co-authored with fellow archaeologist Lindsay Allison-Jones, is also available in full on the PAST website. And make sure to check out the website for some sculpture-related archive features as well. But before you do that, here's my conversation with this week's guest. So Ian, thanks very much for joining me this afternoon. I was wondering to begin with if you could give me a brief introduction to the Elusive Sculptures project and how it came about.
Well, thank you. It was really a very fortuitous combination of interests on behalf of myself as the principal investigator and Lindsay Allison-Jones, who's the co-investigator. Both of us have worked in the archaeology of Roman Britain for a long time, and both of us recognise the extraordinary amount of material that there is still to uncover, but also the material that is in some ways uncovered but needs further study. I had been working for quite a long time, amongst other things, on using new imaging techniques as a research tool, and now allowing us to see objects that were perhaps otherwise hard to read, and this could be inscriptions or it could be sculpted stone. And I'd done this not only in the frontier area of Roman Britain, but also on material from elsewhere in the world. And Lindsay had had a long-standing engagement with that magnificent adventure, which is the Corpus Signorum Imperii Romani. That is a large-scale program to ensure that every bit of sculpted stone, ideally, from the Roman Empire and associated with the Roman world, ultimately gets documented. So it's a huge endeavor. And Britain has been very well served as a result of the hard work of many people. And Lindsay was basically following up on the last region to be so studied and was coming across the added challenge that some of the stones in that area were, as we call them, elusive. They were hard to access. And so this was an opportunity. They're hard to access for researchers, for those who are trying to understand them. And that difficulty can come about for various different reasons. So some of them, for example, might be actually physically relatively accessible, but actually to be able to identify the information on them is really challenging. Others might be very physically hard to access, and we had to find other ways of doing things. And so it was a combination, really, of methods and approaches that brought us together for the Elusive Sculptures project. And we brought with us team members I'd worked with before, including Alex Turner, who is a fantastic colleague, a very able archaeologist in so many different ways, and John Allison, a research associate with me, who recently enjoyed the discovery, famously, of extra detail when he abseiled down the written rock of Gelt, and current archaeology covered that as a separate story.
Yes, and how do you go about tracing these elusive sculptures so that you can go and document them?
Well, here I was especially lucky to have the opportunity to work with Lindsay Allison-Jones. Lindsay had already been on the trail of a number of these inscriptions, and the information comes from all sorts of different sources. So we have, of course, as you'll be very well aware, various national records of finds in different places. We also have, in the regions we're studying, a fantastic history of antiquarian investigation. And we also have the generosity, and I must emphasize this thing very strongly, the generosity of lots and lots of people who come forward with ideas. And they sometimes are interesting, but from the point of view of Roman sculpture, slightly misplaced ideas. People might see something that they think is Roman and isn't, but sometimes they're absolutely on the nail and it's not been spotted or has not had academic interest involved. Other pieces just seem to have a mysteriously elusive aspect, given that They're in plain sight, but no one has actually really ever written them up. And it's not quite clear why, but they just haven't been written up properly. And so we track those down as well. So word of mouth plays a role too.
Very good. Yes, it's people actually coming forward to you rather than you going out to find them yourself sometimes.
It's a combination. I mean, I think in a number of cases, when we look at the stones, they have extraordinarily long biographies. Some of them were sketched occasionally very badly or recorded in an incredibly misleading way centuries ago. But the very fact that somebody actually recognized that they were pieces of importance was a clue. And then one chases this information, sometimes literally over the centuries. Sometimes you're left with a scenario, and Lindsay dealt with this incredibly deftly, I must say, where you've got a scenario where, is this in fact the same object that's being referred to by these two very different eyewitnesses or commentators, or are there two of them? And of course, occasionally the identifications are correct in that people have observed their Roman stones, but people have seen them differently. We've even had divinities that we can now identify as male divinities that are actually were initially recorded as female, and vice versa. So that's quite an important part of the detection, really, connecting all of those documents.
And can you tell me some more about the kinds of places that these sculptures tend to be found? Because in your article, you do talk about a quite unusual place. I think it was a pigsty, wasn't it?
That's right. This was the pigsty was the marvelous Hercules in a pigsty. You know, that I take my hat off to Lindsay, because it was actually Lindsay who was our person on the spot for the pigsty Hercules, and that had apparently been protected by a fairly aggressive pig for some time. So you have to choose your moments. But there were a number of other places. I mean, we were up ladders in all sorts of places, staring up people's chimneys. In some cases, in open grass, you know, in open moorland, looking at stones in areas which people must have walked past 1,000 times without knowing what was lying immediately beneath their feet. All sorts of people threw open spaces that were dear to them to let us get access. And of course, churches were a particularly significant set of repositories for some of this material. And that was fascinating again. So we owe a huge debt to all the generous hosts and homeowners. And, you know, one of the interesting points, of course, that I have to note is that these fine people were doing us a big favour, not only in turning out and letting us access this, but we're going onto private land. We are photographing objects that obviously that people want to keep safe. They're generally very well cared for indeed. And so it took us to some marvelous places, and that was part of the privileged journey of elusive sculptures.
And what sort of subjects do these sculptures tend to depict?
Well, one of the things that I think is important to note is elusive sculptures actually looks at all forms of sculpture. So sometimes when we're looking at sculptures, we may be looking at literally a piece of sculpted stone. It might be, for example, the side of an altar. It might be an architectural element. So they're not always figural sculpture, which the term often leads people to imagine as being, you know, what we're talking about. But when we do look at figural sculpture, sometimes we're getting funerary material. That's not unusual. And material of a cultic nature. So we get we've been lucky enough to record some fine divinities in the process. They range from deities who look like little more than armed and dangerous stick people through to some really gloriously coiffured and arrayed gods and goddesses.
Do you have a favourite?
Yes, I have. My favourite, which brings together so many different themes, would undoubtedly be what we call the scandalous trough of the Lund. And that's from Lancashire. And this is now on display. On display is the wrong word. It's a natural part of the Church of St. John the Evangelist. And it has its name, the Scandalous Trough, because it actually appears that way in parish, in the records of the parish vestry from 1701. And it records that one Matt Hall, the church warden of Kirkham, in 1688, set up a scandalous trough for a font in Lun Chapel. And this this font actually is clearly a Roman altar. On the front of it are the three mothers, Romano-Celtic divinities. And what makes it particularly splendid and unique is that on either side of it, we also have dancing figures. And so we're quite used in the archaeology of Roman Britain to seeing images of the matres, but to actually see these other figures associated with them raises all sorts of marvelous questions. Are these devotees? Are they another facet of the matres that are not normally depicted? Anyway, it's marvelous. And even though it might have been recorded as somewhat scandalous in 1701, it's absolutely delightful to see it continues to operate as a font at the church to this day.
And yes, you mentioned this a little bit already, but in terms of recording them, the project has used a different technology. I think it's structure from motion photography, and then white light scanners. I was reading this and I don't know what these are, so you'll probably have to explain them to me.
Okay. So I think one of the things is there are a lot of interesting imaging technologies out there. And I think two things. One, conventional photography is a tried and trusted method. It's a very effective method. And it can, particularly with appropriate lighting equipment, really get very subtly detailed images. So it's a familiar system. And in many cases, it's preferable. I think also if you're dealing with good control, it captures the colors very well of the object. And color is, of course, an important thing. But there are times when it can be really quite difficult to get a good angle to get a good digital photograph, for example. We all know this. It might be quite difficult because of where it's been positioned, where it's been built into a chimney or a wall or whatever. Because after all, we may be pursuing these sculptures with great enthusiasm, but many of them have gone through a phase where they were just received as another lump of stone to be incorporated into a wall somewhere or even a pigsty. So you've got that sort of challenge sometimes with getting a good image. So we tend to try and use three systems and see what works. And this was particularly the case with the most elusive, the hardest to reach or hardest to read of stones. So conventional photography, where it worked. Structure from motion is sometimes called as photogrammetry. Very, very simply, really, it's taking a series of 2D photographs with a fixed focal length lens from multiple different angles. And using you can process those images together using an appropriate software, and what that will do is it will help you ultimately to generate a 3D model, because it overlays all of these images from different angles. Actually doing it can be rather more technical than that, but at the end of the day, that's what it boils down to. It can be an incredibly effective method. It is sometimes difficult to deploy when, again, larger objects are in small cluttered spaces, or indeed when access to parts of the object is very difficult. You can't get, for example, an angle on the stone that will allow you to capture that three-dimensionality. But three-dimensionality is important because what we're aspiring to sometimes when we're reading objects is, of course, the way in which light passes across an object can make, through the fall of shadow, some aspects of it more visible and other aspects less visible. So it's a common trick, and we're used to doing this also with inscriptions. It's a very common trick to manipulate models so that we can actually, by the fall of light, so we can pick out details. So that's why 3D recording is so important. That also brings us to the other system that you mentioned a moment ago, which is structured light scanning. And basically, we used a number of different structured light scanners, but what all of them have in common is they employ video frames capture through a series of lenses that are arranged in such a way that the software can actually calculate the 3D position of the surface of an object and translate that into essentially a triangulated model. Now, also important for us is that these systems have strobe lighting built into them, so they provide local illumination. And if you're working in very difficult spaces where you've got very poor light, that becomes very important. Now, with this system too, there can be quite a lot of post-processing work to do. That is to say, you don't just go and image the object, you have to work on some of the post-processing. But the results can be remarkable.
And yes, a final question. I mean, obviously, with the publication of these finds, you've finished your work on the hinterland of Hadrian's Wall. Do you think there are any more elusive sculptures anywhere else in Britain or indeed beyond its shores? Some way an obvious question. I'm sure the answer is yes.
Well, it's a superb question, because the answer is emphatically yes. I think that will be one of the things I'd like our listeners today to be thinking about. You know, the colleagues who produced existing volumes of CSIR have done an extraordinary job. I think, first of all, only a few of them have been lucky enough to work with Lindsay Ellison-Jones, and I think her pursuit of some of these is all bordering on the heroic. So there will be pieces that have slipped out of people's notes. Secondly, of course, Roman Britain continues to be a really exciting place with new stuff coming up all the time. So some sculptures are elusive in the sense that they're currently underground, but they may be visiting us sometime soon, and we'll need to record them well. Some of the published work, the images are either not of the highest quality because it's just sometimes difficult to access them. And we did have a team. We had, I think, very important to note here, we had the support of the British Academy and the Leverhulme Trust, and they funded this work, something I should emphasize repeatedly, actually, throughout this podcast. They funded this work. They made this work happen. And other colleagues haven't been that fortunate. So having that allowed us to follow up that little bit further, to get images that I hope are generally of a higher quality and to allow research. Now, I framed that answer particularly in the context of Britain, but it's worth noting that this adventure, as I called it, this in the most positive sense, to record all of Rome's sculpture, can take us around the Roman world and indeed beyond. And while a huge amount of work has gone on, Britain is still, in proportion to the sculpture we have in Britain, is, you know, the most intensely covered of all of Rome's provinces from the point of view of CSIR. So there is much more work to be done. There are many more pieces that elude public gaze and research interest. And I hope that other colleagues will be inspired by this, but also learn from our mistakes, and I've certainly made many, in order to track down a few more of those elusive sculptures in the future.
Very good. Well, yes, I hope that definitely happens, because it's a very interesting project, and I was very intrigued reading about it. So thank you, Ian, for talking to me today.
You're welcome, Kellen. Thank you.
That was Ian Haynes talking to me there. And don't forget that you can read his article in full in the latest issue of Current Archaeology magazine, as well as online at the PAST website. And if you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate us, positively that is, and subscribe, and perhaps even share it around. That's all for this week. Thanks to my guest, Ian Haynes, for talking to me, and to you for listening. We hope you'll join us again soon.